for we had agreed that it would not do for her to come to the station, too much like a formal engagement. But the night before I left, she had confided that in spite of her best efforts to keep the image of Percy bright in her heart, she had discovered that she really loved me, and would love me forever, and wait until I returned from the battlefields of Europe.
Chapter 2 I Am Born Again 1 I shall say little about the war, because though I was in it from early 1915 until late 1917, I never found out much about it until later. Commanders and historians are the people to discuss wars. I was in the infantry, and most of the time I did not know where I was or what I was doing, except that I was obeying orders and trying not to be killed in any of the variety of horrible ways open to me. Since then I have read enough to know a little of the actions in which I took part, but what the historians say throws no great light on what I remember, because I do not want to posture in this account of myself as anything other than what I was at the time of my narrative. I shall write here only of what I knew when it happened. When I left Deptford for the training camp, I had never been away from home alone before. I found myself among men more experienced in the world than I, and I tried not to attract attention by any kind of singular behavior. Some of them knew I was desperately homesick and were kindly. Others jeered at me and the other very young fellows. They were anxious to make men of us, by which they meant making us like themselves. Some of them were men, indeed, grave, slow young farmers and artisans with apparently boundless resources of strength and courage. Others were just riffraff of the kind you get in any chance collection of men. None of them had much education. None had any clear idea what the war was about, though many felt that England had been menaced and had to be defended. Perhaps the most astonishing thing was that none of us had much notion of geography, and thought that going to fight in France might involve almost any kind of climate, from the pole to the equator. Of course, some of us had geography in school and had studied maps, but a school map is a terribly uncommunicative thing. I was a member of the 2nd Canadian Division, and later we were part of the Canadian Corps, but such descriptions meant little to me. I was aware of the men directly around me, and rarely had a chance to meet any others. I might as well say at once that although I was on pretty good terms with everybody, I made no lasting friends. There were men who formed strong friendships, which sometimes led to acts of bravery, and there were men who were great on what they called pals, and talked and sang loudly about it. Those now living are still at it. But I was a lonely creature, and although I would have been very happy to have a friend, I just never happened to meet one. Probably my boredom was to blame, for I was bored, as I have never been since, bored till every bone in my body was heavy with it. This was not the boredom of inactivity. An infantry trainee is kept on the hop from morning till night, and his sleep is sound. It was the boredom that comes of being cut off from everything that could make life sweet, or arouse curiosity, or enlarge the range of the senses. It was the boredom that comes of having to perform endless tasks that have no savor and acquire skills one would gladly be without. I learned to march and drill and shoot and keep myself clean according to army standards, to make my bed and polish my boots and my buttons, and to wrap lengths of dung-colored rag around my legs in the approved way. None of it had any great reality for me, but I learned to do it all, and even to do it well. Thus, when I went home for my leave before going abroad, I was an object of some wonderment. I was a man, in appearance. My mother was almost silenced, so far as her customary criticism went. She made a few attempts to reduce me to the status of her own dear laddie, but I was not willing to play that game. Leola Cruikshank was proud to be seen with me, and we got a little beyond the kissing stage in our last encounter. I desperately wanted to see Mrs. Dempster, but it was impossible, for in my uniform I was unable to go anywhere without being noticed. And though I would have died rather than admit it, I was still too much afraid of my mother to defy her openly. Paul I saw once, but I do not think he knew me, for he stared and passed by. So off I went on a troop ship, lectured by officers who were anxious to harden us with tales of German atrocities. These Germans, I gathered, were absolute devils. Not winning campaigns, but maiming children, ravishing women, never less than 10 to a single victim. and insulting religion were the things they had gone to war to accomplish. They took their tone from their Kaiser, who was a comic mad monster. They had to be shown that decency still ruled the world, and we were decency incarnate. I had by that time seen enough of army life to think that if we were decency, the Germans must be rough indeed, or a more foul-mouthed, thieving, whoring lot of toughs than some of the soldiers I met, it would be hard to imagine. But I was not discontented with soldiering. I was discontented with myself, with my loneliness and boredom. In France, though my boredom was unabated, loneliness was replaced by fear. I was, in a mute, controlled, desperate fashion, frightened for the next 3 years. I saw plenty of men whose fear found vent. They went mad, or they shot themselves, dead or badly enough to get out of service. Or they were such nuisances to the rest of us that they were got rid of in one way or another. But I think there were many in my own case, frightened of death, of wounds, of being captured, but most frightened of admitting to fear and losing face before the others. This kind of fear is not acute, of course. It is a constant depleting companion whose presence makes everything gray. Sometimes fear could be forgotten, but never for long. I saw a good deal of service, for I was strong, did not break down, and miraculously suffered no wounds. I had leaves, when it was possible to grant them, but for months on end I was at what was called the front. What it was the front of I never really knew, for there were always men who were ready to tell, God knows how accurately, where the Allied troops were disposed, and where we were in relation to the British and the French, and from what they said it seemed the front was everywhere. But certainly we were often only a few hundred yards from the German lines and could see the enemy, in their cooking-pot helmets, quite clearly. If you were such a fool as to show your head, they might put a bullet through it, and we had men detailed for the same ugly work. It seems now to have been a very odd war, for we have had another since then, which has set the standard for modernity of fighting. I saw things that now make my pupils regard me as comparable to one of Wellington's men, or perhaps Marlborough's. My war was greatly complicated by horses, for motor vehicles were useless in Flanders mud. If one was among the horses during a bombardment, as I once chanced to be, the animals were just as dangerous as the German shells. I even saw cavalry, for there were still generals who thought that if they could once get at the enemy with cavalry, the machine guns would quickly be silenced. These cavalrymen were as wondrous to me as crusaders, but I would not have been on one of their horses for the earth. And of course I saw corpses, and grew used to their unimportant look, for a dead man without any of the panoply of death is a desperately insignificant object. Worse, I saw men who were not corpses, but who would be soon, and who longed for death. It was the indignity, the ignominy, the squalor to which war reduced a wounded man that most ate into me. Men in agony, smashed so that they will never be whole again, even if they live, ought not to be something one ignores. But we learn to ignore them, and I have put my foot on many a wretched fellow and pushed him even deeper into the mud, because I had to get over him and on to some spot that we had been ordered to achieve or die in trying. This was fighting, when at least we were doing something. But for days and weeks there was not much fighting, during which we lived in trenches, in dung-colored mud into which dung and every filthiness had been trodden, in our dung-colored uniforms. We were cold, badly fed, and lousy. We had no privacy whatever, and began to doubt our individuality, for we seemed to melt into a mass. This was what the sergeants feared, and they did astonishing work in keeping that danger at bay, most of the time. Occasionally the horrible loss of personality, the listlessness of degradation, got beyond them, and then we had to be sent to the rear, to what were called rest camps. We never rested in them, but at least we could draw a full breath without the lime and dung stench of the latrines in it. In spite of the terribly public quality of a soldier's life, in which I ate, slept, stood, sat, thought, voided my bowels, and felt the dread of death upon me, always among others, I found a little time for reading. But I had only one book, a New Testament some well-meaning body had distributed in thousands to the troops. It would never have been my choice. If it had to be the Bible, I would have taken the Old Testament any day. But I would rather have had some big, meaty novels. But where could a private soldier keep such things? I have read often since those days of men who went through the war with books of all sorts, but they were officers. Once or twice on leaves I got hold of a book or two in English, but lost them as soon as we had to fight. Only my testament could be kept in my pocket without making a big bulge, and I read it to the bone, over and over. This gained me a disagreeable reputation as a religious fellow, a holy Joe, and even the chaplain avoided that kind, for they were sure trouble, one way or another. My nickname was Deacon because of my testament reading. It was useless to explain that I read it not from zeal, but curiosity, and that long passages of it confirmed my early impression that religion and Arabian Nights were true in the same way. Later I was able to say that they were both psychologically rather than literally true, and that psychological truth was really as important in its own way as historical verification. But while I was a young soldier, I had no vocabulary for such argument, though I sensed the truth of it. I think Revelation was my favorite book. The Gospels seemed less relevant to me then than John's visions of the beasts and the struggle of the crowned woman who had the moon beneath her feet with the great red dragon. The nickname Deacon stuck to me until, in one of the rest camps, word went out that an impromptu show was being organized, and men were called on to volunteer if they would do something to amuse the troops. With a gall that now staggers me, I forced myself to offer an imitation of Charlie Chaplin, whom I had seen exactly twice in film shows for the troops behind the lines. I managed to get the right kind of hat from a Frenchman in the nearby village. I cut myself a little cane from a bush, and when the night came, I put on a burnt-cork mustache and shuffled onto the platform. For 12 minutes, I told the dirtiest jokes I knew, attaching them to all the officers, including the chaplain, and all the men who had some sort of public character. I now blush at what I remember of what I said. But I drew heavily on the repertoire of Milo Papel, and was astonished to find myself a great hit. Even the former vaudevillian, who could sing If You Were the Only Girl in the World and I Were the Only Boy, in a baritone and falsetto duet with himself, was less admired. And from that time forth I was called not Deacon, but Charlie. What really astonished me was the surprise of the men that I could do such a thing. Jesus, the old deacon, eh? Getting off that hot one about the major, eh? Jesus, and that riddle about Cookie, eh? Jesus! They could hardly conceive that anybody who read the Testament could be other than a holy Joe, could have another seemingly completely opposite side to his character. I cannot remember a time when I did not take it as understood that everybody has at least 2, if not 22, sides to him. Their astonishment was what astonished me. Jesus, eh? People don't look very closely at other people, eh? Jesus. I did not philosophize in the trenches. I endured. I even tried to make a good job of what I had to do. If I had not been so young and handicapped by lack of education, measured in school terms, for the army did not know that I was a polymath and would not have cared, I might have been sent off for training as an officer. As it was, I eventually became a sergeant. Casualties were heavy, which is the army way of saying that men I had known and liked were exploded like bombs of guts almost under my nose. And my success in hiding my fear was enough to get me a reputation for having a cool head. So a sergeant I became, as well as a veteran of Sanctuary Wood and Vimy Ridge, before I was 20. But I think my most surprising achievement was becoming Charlie. 2. My fighting days came to an end somewhere in the week of 5 November, 1917. At that point in the Third Battle of Ypres, where the Canadians were brought in to attempt to take Passchendaele. It was a Thursday or Friday. I cannot be more accurate because many of the details of that time are clouded in my mind. The battle was the most terrible of my experience. We were trying to take a village that was already a ruin, and we counted our advances in feet. The front was a confused mess because it had rained every day for weeks, and the mud was so dangerous that we dared not make a forward move without a laborious business of putting down duckboards, lifting them as we advanced, and putting them down again ahead of us. Understandably, this was so slow and exposed that we could not do much of it. I learned from later reading that our total advance was a little less than 2 miles. It might have been 200. The great terror was the mud. The German bombardment churned it up so that it was horribly treacherous, and if a man sank in much over his knees, his chances of getting out were poor. A shell exploding nearby could cause an upheaval that overwhelmed him, and the likelihood even of recovering his body was small. I write of this now as briefly as I may, for the terror of it was so great that I would not for anything arouse it again. One of the principal impediments to our advance was a series of German machine-gun emplacements. I suppose they were set out according to some plan, but we were not in a position to observe any plan. In the tiny area I knew about, there was one of these things, and it was clear that we would get no farther forward until it was silenced. 2 attempts were made at this dangerous job, with terrible loss to us. I could see how things were going, and how the list of men who might be expected to get to that machine-gun nest was dwindling, and I knew it would come to me next. I do not remember if we were asked to volunteer. Such a request would have been merely formal anyhow. Things had reached a point where pretense of choice disappeared. Anyhow, I was one of 6 who were detailed to make a night raid in one of the intervals of bombardment, to see if we could get to the machine guns and knock them out. We were issued the small arms and other things we needed, and when the bombardment had stopped for 5 minutes, we set out, not in a knot, of course, but spaced a few yards apart. The men in the nest were expecting us, for we were doing exactly what their side would have done in the same situation. But we crawled forward, spread-eagled in the mud so as to spread our total weight over as wide an area as possible. It was like swimming in molasses, with the additional misery that it was molasses that stank and had dead men in it. I was making pretty good progress when suddenly everything went wrong. Somebody, it could have been someone on our side at a distance, or it could have been one of the Germans in the nest, sent up a flare. You do not see where these flares come from, because they explode in the air and light up the landscape for a considerable area. When such a thing happens, and you are crawling toward an objective, as I was, the proper thing to do is to lie low, with your face down, and hope not to be seen. As I was mud from head to foot, and had blackened my face before setting out, I would have been hard to see, and if seen, I would have looked like a dead man. After the flare had died out, I crept forward again and made a fair amount of distance, so far as I could judge. I did not know where the others were, but I assumed that, like me, they were making for the gun nest and waiting for a signal from our leader, a second lieutenant, to do whatever we could about it. But now 3 flares exploded, and immediately there began a rattle of machine gun fire. Again, I laid low. But it is the nature of flares, when they are over the arc of their trajectory, to come down with a rush and a characteristic loud hiss. If you are hit by one, it is a serious burn, for the last of the flare is still a large gob of fire, and between burning to death or drowning in mud, the choice is trivial. 2 of these spent flares were hissing in the air above me, and I had to get out of where I was as fast as I could. So I got to my feet and ran. Now, at a time when we had counted on at least a half an hour's lull in the bombardment, it suddenly set up again, and to my bleak horror, our own guns, from a considerable distance to the left, began to answer. This sort of thing was always a risk when we were out on small raids, but it was a risk I had never met before. As the shells began to drop, I ran wildly, and how long I wallowed around in the dark I do not know, but it could have been anything between 3 minutes and 10. I became aware of a deafening rattle with the rhythm of an angry, scolding voice on my right. I looked for some sort of cover, and suddenly, in a burst of light, there it was right in front of me, an entry concealed by some trash, but unmistakably a door over which hung a curtain of muddy sacking. I pushed through it and found myself in the German machine gun nest, with 3 Germans ahead of me, firing busily. I had a revolver, and I shot all 3 at point-blank range. They did not even see me. There is no use saying any more about it. I am not proud of it now, and I did not glory in it then. War puts men in situations where these things happen. What I wanted to do most of all was to stay where I was and get my breath and my wits before starting back to our line. But the bombardment was increasing, and I knew that if I stopped there, one of our shells might drop on the position and blow me up, or the Germans, whose field telephone was already signaling right under my nose, would send some men to see what had happened, and that would be the end of me. I had to get out. So out I crawled, into mud below and shells above, and tried to get my bearings. As both sides were now at the peak of a bombardment, it was not easy to tell which source of death I should crawl toward, and by bad luck I set out toward the German lines. How long I crawled I do not know, for I was by this time more frightened, muddled, and desperate than ever before or since. Disorientation is the word now fashionable for my condition. Quite soon I was worse than that. I was wounded, and so far as I could tell, seriously. It was shrapnel, a fragment of an exploding shell, and it hit me in the left leg, though where I cannot say. I have been in a car accident in later life, and the effect was rather like that. A sudden shock like a blow from a club. And it was a little time before I knew that my left leg was in trouble, though I could not tell how bad it was. Earlier I said that I had not been wounded. There were a surprising number of men who escaped the war without a wound. I had not been gassed either, though I had been twice in areas where gas was used nearby. I had dreaded a wound, for I had seen so many. What is a wounded man to do? Crawl to shelter and hope he may be found by his own people. I crawled. Some men found that their senses were quickened by a wound. Their ingenuity rose to exceptional heights under stress of danger. But I was one of the other kind. I was not so much afraid as utterly disheartened. There I was, a mud man in a confusion of noise, flashing lights, and the stink of gelignite. I wanted to quit. I had no more heart for the game. But I crawled, with the increasing realization that my left leg was no good for anything and had to be dragged, and the awful awareness that I did not know where I was going. After a few minutes I saw some jagged masonry on my right and dragged toward it. When at last I reached it, I propped myself up with my back to a stone wall and gave myself up to a full, rich recognition of the danger and hopelessness of my position. For 3 years I had kept my nerve by stifling my intelligence, but now I let the intelligence rip and the nerve dissolve. I am sure there has been worse wretchedness, fright, and despair in the world's history, but I set up a personal record that I have never since approached. My leg began to declare itself in a way that I can only describe in terms of sound. From a mute condition, it began to murmur, then to moan and whine, then to scream. I could not see much of what was wrong because of the mud in which I was covered, but my exploring hand found a great stickiness that I knew was blood, and I could make out that my leg lay on the ground in an unnatural way. "You will get tetanus," I told myself, "and you will die of lockjaw." It was a Deptford belief that in this disease you bent backward until at last your head touched your heels and you had to be buried in a round coffin. I had seen some tetanus in the trenches, and nobody had needed a round coffin, even if one had been available. Still, in my condition, the belief was stronger than experience. I thought of Deptford, and I thought of Mrs. Dempster, particularly of her parting words to me. "There's just one thing to remember. Whatever happens, it does no good to be afraid." Mrs. Dempster, I said aloud, was a fool. I was afraid, and I was not in a situation where doing good or doing evil had any relevance at all. It was then that one of the things happened that make my life strange, one of the experiences that other people have not had or do not admit to, one of the things that makes me so resentful of Packer's estimate of me as a dim man to whom nothing important has ever happened. I became conscious that the bombardment had ceased, and only an occasional gun was heard. But flares appeared in the sky at intervals, and one of these began to drop toward me. By its light, I could see that the remnant of standing masonry in which I was lying was all that was left of a church, or perhaps a school. Anyhow, a building of some size, and that I lay at the foot of a ruined tower. As the hissing flame dropped, I saw there, about 10 or 12 feet above me, on an opposite wall, in a niche, a statue of the Virgin and Child. I did not know it then, but I know now that it was the assembly of elements that represent the Immaculate Conception, for the little Virgin was crowned, stood on a crescent moon, which in its turn rested on a globe, and in the hand that did not hold the child she carried a scepter from which lilies sprang. Not knowing what it was meant to be, I thought in a flash it must be the crowned woman in Revelation, she who had the moon beneath her feet and was menaced by the red dragon. But what hit me worse than the blow of the shrapnel was that the face was Mrs. Dempster's face. I had lost all nerve long before. Now, as the last of the flare hissed towards me, I lost consciousness. 3.
May I have a drink of water?
Did you speak?
Yes, may I have a drink, sister?
You may have a glass of champagne, if there is any. Who are you?
Ramsay D., Sergeant, 2nd Canadian Division.
Well, Ramsay D., it's marvelous to have you with us.
Where is this?
You'll find out. Where have you been?
Ah, where had I been? I didn't know then, and I don't know yet, but it was such a place as I had never known before.
Years later, when for the first time I read Coleridge's Kubla Khan and came on, "Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey dew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise," I almost jumped out of my skin, for the words so perfectly described my state before I woke up in hospital. I had been wonderfully at ease and healingly at peace, though from time to time voices spoke to me, I was under no obligation to hear what they said or to make a reply. I felt that everything was good, that my spirit was wholly my own, and that though all was strange, nothing was evil. From time to time the little Madonna appeared and looked at me with friendly concern before removing herself. Once or twice she spoke, but I did not know what she said, and did not need to know. But here I was, apparently in bed, and a very pretty girl in a nurse's uniform was asking me where I had been. Clearly she meant it as a joke. She thought she knew where I had been. That meant that the joke was on her, for no one, not I myself, knew that.
Is this a base hospital?
Goodness, no. How do you feel, Ramsay D.?
Fine. What day is this?
This is the 12th of May. I'll get you a drink. She disappeared, and I took a few soundings. It was not easy work. The last time I had been conscious of was November. If this was May, I had been in that splendid, carefree world for quite a while. I wasn't in such a bad place now. I couldn't move my head very much, but I could see a marvelously decorated plaster ceiling, and such walls as lay in my vision were paneled in wood. There was an open window somewhere, and sweet air, no stink of mud or explosive or corpses or latrines, was blowing through it. I was clean. I wriggled appreciatively, and wished I hadn't, for several parts of me protested. But here was the girl again, and with a red-faced man in a long white coat. He seemed greatly elated, especially when I was able to remember my army number. And though I did not learn why at once, I found out over a few days that I was by way of being a medical pet, and my recovery proved something. Being merely the patient, I was never given the full details, but I believe I was written up in at least 2 medical papers as a psychiatric curiosity. But as I was referred to only as the patient, I could never identify myself for sure. The red-faced man was some sort of specialist in shell-shock cases, and I was one of his successes, though I rather think I cured myself, or the little Madonna cured me, or some agencies other than good nursing and medical observation. Oh, I was a lucky man. Apparently the flare did hit me, and before it expired it burned off a good part of my clothes and consumed the string of my identification discs, so that when I was picked up they were lost in the mud. There had been some doubt as to whether I was dead or merely on the way to it, but I was taken back to our base, and as I stubbornly did not die, I was removed eventually to a hospital in France, and as I still refused either to die or live, I was shipped to England. By this time I was a fairly interesting instance of survival against all probabilities, and the red-faced doctor had claimed me for his own. I was brought to this special hospital in a fine old house in Buckinghamshire, and had lain unconscious, and likely to remain so, though the red-faced doctor stubbornly insisted that some day I would wake up and tell him something of value. So here it was, May, and I was awake, and the hospital staff were delighted and made a great pet of me. They had other news for me, not so good. My burns had been severe, and in those days they were not so clever with burns as they are now, so that quite a lot of the skin on my chest and left side was an angry-looking mess, rather like lumpy sealing wax, and is so still, though it is a little browner now. In the bed, on the left side, was an arrangement of wire, like a B-skip, to keep the sheets from touching the stump where my left leg had been. While my wits were off on that paradisal holiday, I had been fed liquids, and so I was very thin and weak. What is more, I had a full beard, and the pretty nurse and I had a rare old time getting it off. Let me stop calling her the pretty nurse. Her name was Diana Marfleet, and she was one of those volunteers who got a proper nursing training but never acquired the full calm of a professional nursing sister. She was the first English girl I ever saw at close range, and a fine specimen of her type, which was the fair-skinned, dark-haired, brown-eyed type. Not only was she pretty, she had charm and an easy manner and talked amusingly, for she came of that class of English person who thinks it bad manners to be factual and serious. She was 24, which gave her an edge of 4 years over me, and it was not long before she confided to me that her fiancé, a Navy lieutenant, had been lost when the Aboukir was torpedoed in the very early days of the war. We were on tremendous terms in no time, for she had been nursing me since I had come to the hospital in January, and such nourishment as I had taken had been spooned and poured into me by her. She had also washed me, and attended to the bedpan and the urinal, and continued to do so. A girl who can do that without being facetious or making a man feel self-conscious is no ordinary creature. Diana was a wonderful girl, and I am sure I gained strength and made physical progress at an unusual rate to please her. One day she appeared at my bedside with a look of great seriousness and saluted me smartly. "What's that for?" "Tribute of humble nursing sister to hero of Passchendaele." "Get away." This was a great expression of my father's, and I have never wholly abandoned it. "Fact. What do you think you've got?"
"I rather think I've got you."
"No cheek. We've been tracing you, Sergeant Ramsay. Did you know that you were officially dead?"
"Dead? Me?"
"You.
That's why your VC was awarded posthumously."
"Get away."
"Fact.
You have the VC, for with the utmost gallantry and disregard of all but duty, clearing out a machine-gun nest and thereby ensuring an advance of, I don't know how far, but quite a bit, you were the only one of the six who didn't get back to the line, and one of the men saw you, your unmistakable size anyhow, running right towards the machine-gun nest. So it was clear enough, even though they couldn't find your body afterward. Anyway, you've got it, and Dr. Hunin is making sure you do get it, and it isn't sent home to depress your mother." The other three men in the room gave a cheer, an ironic cheer. We all pretended we didn't care about decorations, but I never heard of anybody turning one down. Diana was very sorry in a few days that she had said what she did about the medal going home to my mother, for a letter arrived from the Reverend Donald Phillips in reply to one Dr. Hunin had sent to my parents, saying that Alexander Ramsay and his wife, Fiona Dunstable Ramsay, had both died in the influenza epidemic of early 1918, though not before they had received news of my presumed death at Passchendaele. Diana was ashamed because she thought she might have hurt my feelings. I was ashamed because I felt the loss so little. 4. It was years before I thought of the death of my parents as anything other than a relief. In my 30s I was able to see them as real people who had done the best they could in the lives fate had given them. But as I lay in that hospital, I was glad that I did not have to be my mother's own dear laddie any longer, or ever attempt to explain to her what war was, or warp my nature to suit her confident demands. I knew she had eaten my father, and I was glad I did not have to fight any longer to keep her from eating me. Oh, these good, ignorant, confident women! How one grows to hate them! I was mean-spiritedly pleased that my mother had not lived to hear of my VC. How she would have paraded in mock modesty as the mother of a hero, the very womb and matrix of bravery,
in consequence of my 3 years of degradation in the Flanders mud. I confided none of this to Diana, of course. She was intensely curious about my war experience, and I had no trouble at all in talking to her about it. But as I gave her my confidence, and she gave me her sympathy, I was well aware that we were growing very close, and that someday this would have to be reckoned with. I did not care. I was happy to be living at all, and lived only for the sweetness of the moment. She was a romantic, and as I had never met a female romantic before, it was a delight to me to explore her emotions. She wanted to know all about me, and I told her as honestly as I could. But as I was barely 20, and a romantic myself, I know now that I lied in every word I uttered. Lied not in fact, but in emphasis, in color, and in intention. She was entranced by the idea of life in Canada, and I made it entrancing. I even told her about Mrs. Dempster, though not that I was the cause of her distracted state, and felt let down that she did not respond very warmly. But when I told her about the little Madonna at Passchendaele, and later as a visitor to my long coma, she was delighted and immediately gave it a conventionally religious significance, which, quite honestly, had never occurred to me. She returned to this theme again and again, and often I was reminded of the introduction to A Child's Book of Saints and little W.V., for whom those stories had been told. Personally, I had come to think of little W.V. as rather a little pill, but I now reserved my judgment, for Diana was little W.V. to the life, and I was all for Diana. Gradually it broke in upon me that Diana had marked me for her own, and I was too much flattered to see what that might mean. A lot of the nurses in that hospital were girls of good family, and though they worked very hard and did full nursing duty, they had some privileges that cannot have been common. Most of them lived nearby, and they were able to go home in their time off. When Diana returned from these off-duty jaunts, she spoke about her home and her parents, and they seemed to be people unlike parents as I knew them. Her father, Canon Marfleet, was a domestic chaplain at Windsor, as well as a parish clergyman. I had little notion of what a domestic chaplain might be, but I assumed he jawed the royal family about morals, just as the parsons jawed us at home. Her mother was an honorable, though the canon was not, which surprised me, and she had been born a de Blaquiere, which, as Diana pronounced it, de Blaquiere, I did not get straight for some time. Because of the war, the Marfleets were living very simply, only 2 servants and a gardener 3 times a week, and the canon had followed royal example and forbidden alcoholic liquors in his household for the duration, except for a glass or two of port when he felt peaky. They restricted their daily bath water to 3 inches to save fuel for our cause. I had never in my life known anyone who bathed every day, and assumed that the hospital daily bath was some sort of curative measure that would eventually cease. Diana was a very educative experience. As she gradually took me over, she began to correct me about some of my usages which she thought quaint. Not wrong, just quaint. Fortunately, because I had a good measure of Scots in my speech, we did not have the usual haggle of old and new world couples about pronunciations, though she was hilarious about me calling a reel of cotton a spool of thread, and assured me that pants were things one wore under trousers. But she made it clear that one tore bread instead of cutting it neatly, and buttered it only in bites, which I thought a time-wasting affectation. She also stopped me from eating like a man who might not live until his next mouthful, a childhood habit that had been exaggerated in the trenches and that still overcomes me when I am nervous. I liked it. I was grateful. Besides, she did it with humor and charm. There was not a nagging breath in her. Of course, this did not happen all at once. It was some time after I woke from my coma before I could get out of bed, and quite a while after that before I could begin experimenting with the succession of artificial legs that came before my final one. I had to learn to walk with crutches, and because so many of my muscles, especially in the left arm, were scarred or reduced to very little, this took time and hurt. Diana saw me through it all. Literally, I leaned on her, and now and then I fell on her. She was a wonderful nurse. When it was at last possible to do so, she took me home,
and I met the canon and the honorable. The best I can say about them is that they were worthy to be Diana's parents. The canon was a charming man, quite unlike any clergyman I had ever known, and even at the Sunday midday meal he never talked about religion. Like a good Presbyterian, I tried once or twice to pass him a compliment on his discourse at morning service and pursue its theme, but he wanted none of that. He wanted to talk about the war, and as he was well informed and a Lloyd George supporter, it was not the usual hate session in which he invited me to engage. There must have been a lot like him in England, though you would never have known it from the peace we finally made. The Honorable was a wonder, not like a mother at all. She was a witty, frivolous woman of a beauty congruous with her age, about 47, I suppose, and talked as if she hadn't a brain in her head. But I was not deceived. She was what Diana would be at that age, and I liked every bit of it. How my spirit expanded in the home of the Marfleets! To a man who had been where I had been, it was glorious. I only hope I behaved myself and did not talk like a fool. But when I remember those days, I remember the canon and the honorable and Diana and what I felt about them, but little of what I did or said. 5. The patchy quality of my recollection of this period is owing, I suppose, to the exhaustion of 3 years of war. I was out of it at last, and I was happy to take pleasure in security and cleanliness without paying too close attention to what went on. Now and then it was possible to hear the guns in France. Food was short, but better than I had had in the trenches. The news came in ominous newspaper dispatches. Nevertheless, I was happy, and knew that for me, at least, the war was over. My plans were simple: to learn to walk with a crutch, and later with an artificial leg and a cane. Without being positively in love with Diana, I was beglamoured by her and flattered by her attention. I had fought my war and was resting. We did win it at last, and there was a great hullabaloo in the hospital, and on the day after November 11, Dr. Hunin got a car and drove me and another man who was fit for it, and Diana and another nurse, to London to see the fun. The rejoicing was a little too much like an infantry attack for my taste. I had not been in a crowd since I was wounded, and the noise and crush were very alarming to me. Indeed, I have never been much good at enduring noise and crush since late 1917. But I saw some of the excitement, and a few things that shocked me. People, having been delivered from destruction, became horribly destructive themselves. People, having been delivered from license and riot, pawed and mauled and shouted dirty phrases in the streets. Nor am I in any position to talk. It was on the night of November 12, in a house in Eaton Square belonging to one of her de Blackier aunts, that I first slept with Diana, the aunt giving her assent by silence and discreet absence. To me, at least, there seemed something unseemly about the union of my scarred and maimed body with her unblemished beauty. Unseemly or not, it was my first experience of anything of the kind, for I had never been able to bring myself to make use of soldiers' brothels or any of the casual company that was available to men in uniform. Diana was not a novice, the fiancée who went down on the Aboukir, I suppose, and she initiated me most tenderly, for which I shall always be grateful. Thus we became lovers in the fullest sense, and for me the experience was an important step towards the completion of that manhood which had been thrust upon me so one-sidedly in the trenches. The next night, because Diana had luck as well as influence, we had tickets for Chu Chin Chow at His Majesty's, and this was a great experience too, in quite a different way, for I had never seen any theatre more elaborate than a troop show. On one of my two very brief leaves in Paris, I had sought out the site of Robert Houdin's theatre, but it was no longer there. I must have been an odd young man to have supposed that it might still be in existence, but my historical sense developed later. I see that I have been so muddle-headed as to put my sexual initiation in direct conjunction with a visit to a musical show, which suggests some lack of balance, perhaps. But looking back from my present age, the two, though very different, are not so unlike in psychological weight as you might suppose.
Both were wonders, strange lands revealed to me in circumstances of great excitement. I suppose I was still in rather delicate health, mentally as well as physically. The next great moment in my life was the reception of my Victoria Cross from the King himself. Dr. Hunin had established that I was really alive, and so the award that had been published as posthumous was repeated on one of the lists, and in due course I went to Buckingham Palace in a taxi on a December morning and got it. Diana was with me, for I was allowed to invite one guest, and she was the obvious choice. We were looked at with sentimental friendliness by the other people in the room, and I suppose an obviously wounded soldier, accompanied by a very pretty nurse, was about as popular a sight as the time afforded. Most of the details are vague, but a few remain. A military band in an adjoining room played Gems from the Maid of the Mountains, it was Diana who told me, and we all stood around the walls until the king and some aides entered and took a place in the center. When my turn came, I stumped forward on my latest metal leg, making rather a noisy progress, and got myself into the right position, directly in front of the king. Somebody handed him the medal, and he pinned it on my tunic, then shook my hand and said, "I am glad you were able to get here after all." I can still remember what a deep and rather gruff voice he had, and also the splendid neatness of his navy beard. He was a good deal shorter than I, so I was looking down into his very blue, rather glittering eyes, and I thought I had better smile at the royal joke, so I did, and retreated in good order. There was a moment, however, when the king and I were looking directly into each other's eyes, and in that instant I had a revelation that takes much longer to explain than to experience. Here am I reflected, being decorated as a hero. And in the eyes of everybody here, I am indeed a hero. But I know that my heroic act was rather a dirty job I did when I was dreadfully frightened. I could just as easily have muddled it and been ingloriously killed. But it doesn't much matter, because people seem to need heroes. So long as I don't lose sight of the truth, it might as well be me as anyone else. And here before me stands a marvelously groomed little man who is pinning a hero's medal on me, because some of his forebears were Alfred the Great and Charles the First, and even King Arthur, for anything I know to the contrary. But I shouldn't be surprised if inside he feels as puzzled about the fate that brings him here as I. We are public icons, we two. He an icon of kingship, and I an icon of heroism. Unreal, yet very necessary. We have obligations above what is merely personal, and to let personal feelings obscure the obligations would be failing in one's duty. This was clearer still afterward, at lunch at the Savoy, when the canon and the honorable gave us a gay time with champagne. They all seemed to accept me as a genuine hero, and I did my best to behave decently, neither believing in it too obviously, nor yet protesting that I was just a simple chap who had done his duty when he saw it. A pose that has always disgusted me. Ever since, I have tried to think charitably of people in prominent positions of one kind or another. We cast them in roles, and it is only right to consider them as players, without trying to discredit them with knowledge of their offstage life, unless they drag it into the middle of the stage themselves. 6. The business of getting used to myself as a hero was only part of the work I had on hand during my long stay in the hospital. When first I returned to this world, I will not say to consciousness, because it seemed to me that I had been conscious on a different level during what they called my coma. I had to get used to being a man with one leg and a decidedly weakened left arm. I was not so clever at managing these handicaps as were some of the men in that hospital who had lost limbs. I have always been clumsy, and though Diana and the doctor assured me that I would soon walk as well as if I had a real leg, I had no belief in it, and indeed I have never managed to walk without a limp, and feel much happier with a cane. I was very weak physically to begin with, and although I was perfectly sane, I was a little light-headed for several months, and all my recollections of that period are confused by this quality of light-headedness. But I had to get used to being a hero. That is, not to believe it myself, but not to be insulting to those who did so. And I also had to make up my mind about Diana.
There was an unreality about our relationship that had its roots in something more lasting than my light-headedness. I will say nothing against her, and I shall always be grateful to her for teaching me what the physical side of love was. After the squalor of the trenches, her beauty and high spirits were the best medicine I got. But I could not be blind to the fact that she regarded me as her own creation. And why not? Hadn't she fed me, and washed me, and lured me back into this world when I was far away? Didn't she teach me to walk, showing the greatest patience when I was most clumsy? Was she not anxious to retrain me about habits of eating and behavior? But even as I write it down, I know how clear it is that what was wrong between Diana and me was that she was too much a mother to me. And as I had had one mother, and lost her, I was not in a hurry to acquire another. Not even a young and beautiful one with whom I could play Oedipus to both our hearts' content. If I could manage it, I had no intention of being anybody's own dear laddie ever again. That decision, made at that time, has shaped my life, and doubtless in some ways it has warped it, but I still think I knew what was best for me. In the long periods of rest in the hospital, I thought as carefully as I could about my situation, and what emerged was this. I had made a substantial payment to society for anything society had given me or would give me in future. A leg and much of one arm are hard coin. Society had decided to regard me as a hero, and though I knew that I was no more a hero than many other men I had fought with, and less than some who had been killed doing what I could not have done, I determined to let society regard me as it pleased. I would not trade on it, but I would not put it aside either. I would get a pension in due time, and my Victoria Cross carried a resounding $50 a year with it. I would take these rewards and be grateful. But I wanted my life to be my own. I would live henceforth for my own satisfaction. That did not include Diana. She seemed to assume that it did, and perhaps I was unfair to her in not checking her assumptions as soon as I became aware of them. But to be frank, I liked having her in love with me. It fed my spirit, which was at a low ebb. I liked going to bed with her, and as she liked it too, I thought this a fair exchange. But a life with Diana was simply not for me. As girls do, she assumed that we were drifting towards an engagement and marriage. Though she never said so in plain words, it was clear she thought that when I was strong enough we would go to Canada. And if I did not mistake her utterly, she had in her mind's eye a fine big wheat farm in the West, for she had the English delusion that farming was a great way to live. I knew enough about farming to be sure it was not a life for amateurs or wounded men. Every 2 weeks Diana would appear, looking remote and beautiful, and hand me a letter from Leola Cruikshank. These were always difficult occasions because the letters embarrassed me. They were so barren of content, so ill-expressed, so utterly unlike the Leola, all curls and soft lips and whispers, that I remembered. How, I wondered, had I been so stupid as to get myself mixed up with such a pinhead? Diana knew the letters were from a girl, for Leola's guileless writing could not have belonged to any other section of humanity. And intuition told her that, as they were almost the only letters I received, the girl was a special one. I could not have told her how special, for I could no longer remember precisely what pledges I had made to Leola. Was I engaged to her, or was I not? The letters I wrote in reply, and painstakingly smuggled into the post so Diana should not see them, were as noncommittal as I had the heart to make them. I tried to write in such a way as to evoke from Leola some indication of what she believed our relationship to be, without committing myself. This meant subtlety of a kind that was far outside Leola's scope. She was no hand with the pen, and her flat little letters gave Deptford gossip, with all the spice left out, and usually ended, "Everybody looks forward to your coming home, and it will be lovely to see you again. Love, Leola." Was this coolness or maidenly reserve? Sometimes I broke out in a sweat, wondering. One of Leola's letters came just before Christmas, which I had leave to spend with Diana's family. The canon had celebrated the armistice by abandoning the no-alcohol vow, and it looked like being a jolly occasion. I had learned to drink neat rum in the army and was ready for anything. But, on Christmas Eve, Diana contrived a private talk between us and asked me straight out who the girl was who wrote to me from Canada, and was I involved with her. Involved was her word. I had been dreading this question, but had no answer ready, and I havered and floundered, and became aware that Leola's name had an uncouth sound when spoken in such circumstances, and hated myself for thinking so. My whole trouble, jackass that I was, sprang from the fact that I tried to be decently loyal to Leola without hurting Diana, and the more I talked, the worse mess I made of things. In no time, Diana was crying, and I was doing my best to comfort her. But I managed to keep uppermost in my mind the determination I had formed not to get engaged to her, and this led me into verbal acrobatics that quickly brought on a blazing row. Canadian soldiers had an ambiguous reputation in England at that time. We were supposed to be loyal, furious, hairy fellows who spat bullets at the enemy but ate women raw. Diana accused me of being one of these ogres who had led her on to reveal feelings I did not reciprocate. Like a fool, I said I thought she was old enough to know what she thought. Aha, she said. That was it? Because she was older than I, she was a tough old rounder who could look out for herself, was she? Not a bit tough, I countered, frank with a flat-footedness that now makes me blush. But after all, she had been engaged, hadn't she? There it was again, she countered. I thought she was damaged goods. I was throwing it in her face that she had given herself to a man who had died a hero's death in the very first weeks of the war. I looked on her simply as an amusement, a pastime. She had loved me in my weakness without knowing how essentially coarse-fibered I was, and much more to the same effect. Of course, this gave way in time to much gentler exchanges, and we savored the sweet pleasures of making up after a fight. But it was not long before Diana wanted to know, just as someone who wished me well, how far I was committed to Leola. I didn't dare tell her that I wanted to know precisely the same thing. I was too young to be truthful about such a matter. Well then, she continued, was I in love with Leola? I was able to say with a good conscience that I was not. Then I was in love with herself after all, said Diana, making one of those feminine leaps in logic that leave men breathless. I made a long speech about never knowing what people meant when they said they were in love with someone. I loved Diana, I said, I really did, but as for being in love, I babbled a good deal of nonsense that I cannot now recall and would not put down if I did. Diana changed her tactics. I was too intellectual, she said, and analyzed matters on which feeling was the only true guide. If I loved her, she asked no more. What did the future hold for us? I do not want to make Diana seem crafty in my record of this conversation, but I must say that she had a great gift for getting her own way. She had strong ideas on what the future held for us, and I had none, and I am certain she knew it. Therefore, she was putting forward this question not to hear from me, but to inform me. But I had my little store of craft, too. I said that the war had been such a shake-up for me that I had no clear ideas about the future, and certainly had not considered asking her to marry anybody as badly crippled as I. This proved to be a terrible mistake. Diana was so vehement about what a decent woman felt for a man who had been wounded and handicapped in the war, not to speak of a man who had been given the highest award for bravery, that I nearly lost my head and begged her to be my wife. I cannot look back on my young self in this situation without considerable shame and disgust. So far I had been able to reject this girl's love, but I was nearly captured by her flattery. Not that she meant it insincerely. There was nothing insincere about Diana. But she had been raised on a mental diet of heroism, empire, decency, and the emotional superiority of womanhood, and she could talk about these things without a blush, as parsons talk about God. And I was only 20. What a night that was! We talked till 3 o'clock, complicating our situation with endless scruple, as young people are apt to do, and trying not to hurt each other's feelings, despite the fact that Diana wanted to get engaged to me, and I was fighting desperately to prevent any such thing. But I have said before, and I repeat, Diana was really an exceptional girl, and when she saw she was not going to get her way, she gave in with grace. All right, she said, sitting up on the sofa and tidying her hair, for we had been very much entangled during parts of our argument, and my latest artificial leg had been giving some ominous croaks.
If we aren't going to be married, that's that. But what are you going to do, Dunny? Surely you aren't going to marry that girl with a name like a hair tonic and go on editing your father's potty little paper, are you? There's more to you than that.
I agreed that I was sure there was more to me than that, but I didn't know what it was, and I needed time to find out. Furthermore, I knew that the finding out must be done alone. I did not tell Diana that there was the whole question of the little Madonna to be gone into, because I knew that with her conventional Christian background and her generous sentimentality, she would begin then and there to explain it for me, and every scrap of intuition I possessed told me that her explanation would be the wrong one. But I did tell her that I was strongly conscious that my lack of formal education was the greatest handicap I had, and that I felt that somehow I must get to a university. If I went back to Canada and explored all the possibilities, I could probably manage it. It is not easy to put down what one says to a girl in such circumstances, but I managed to make it clear that what I most wanted was time to grow up. The war had not matured me. I was like a piece of meat that is burned on one side and raw on the other, and it was on the raw side I needed to work. I thanked her as well as I could for what she had done for me.
"Let me do one thing more for you," she said. "Let me rename you. How on earth did you ever get yourself called Dunstable?"
"My mother's maiden name," said I. "Lots of people in Canada get landed with their mother's maiden name as a Christian name. But what's wrong with it?"
"It's hard to say, for one thing," said she. "And it sounds like a cart rumbling over cobblestones for another. You'll never get anywhere in the world named Dumbledum Ramsay. Why don't you change it to Dunstan? St. Dunstan was a marvelous person, and very much like you. Mad about learning, terribly stiff and stern and scowly, and an absolute wizard at withstanding temptation. Do you know that the devil once came to tempt him in the form of a fascinating woman, and he caught her nose in his goldsmith's tongs and gave it a terrible twist? I took her nose between my fingers and gave it a twist. This was very nearly the undoing of all that I had gained, but after a while we were talking again. I liked the idea of a new name. It suggested new freedom and a new personality. So Diana got some of her father's port and poured it on my head and renamed me. She was an Anglican, of course, and her light-minded attitude towards some sacred things still astonished the deep Presbyterian in me. But I had not waded through the mud and blood soup of Passchendaele to worry about foolish things. Blasphemy in a good cause, which usually means one's own cause, is not hard to stomach. When at last we went to bed, two splendid things had happened. Diana and I were friends instead of lovers, and I had an excellent new name. Christmas Day was even better than I had foreseen. I am sure Diana's parents knew what was in the wind and were game enough not to stand in the way if we had really wanted to marry. But they were much relieved that we had decided against it. How they knew, I cannot say, but parents are often less stupid than their children suppose, and I suspect the Honorable smelled it in the morning air. After all, what satisfaction would it have been to them to have their daughter marry a man in my physical state, of very different background, and 4 years younger than herself, in order to go off to seek a fortune in a country of which they knew nothing. So they were happy, and I was happy, and I suspect that Diana was a good deal happier than she would ever have admitted. She had fallen in love with me because she felt she had made whatever I was out of a smashed-up and insensible hospital case. But I don't think it was long before she was just as sure as I that our marriage would never have worked. So I lost a possible wife and gained 3 very good friends that Christmas.
7. Getting back to Canada took some time because of the complication of army necessities and my supposedly fragile state. But early in the following May, I got off the train at Deptford, was greeted by the Reeve, Orville Cave, and ceremonially driven around the village as the chief spectacle in a procession. This grandeur had been carefully planned beforehand, by letter, but it was nonetheless astonishing for that. I had little idea of what 4 years of war had done in creating a new atmosphere in Deptford, for it had shown little interest in world affairs in my school days. But here was our village shoe repairman, Moses Langerand, in what was meant to be a French uniform, personating Marshal Foch. He had secured this position on the best possible grounds, being the only French-speaking Canadian for miles around, and having an immense grey moustache. Here was a tall youth I did not know, in an outfit that approximated that of Uncle Sam. There were two John Bulls, owing to some misunderstanding that could not be resolved without hurt feelings. There were Red Cross nurses in plenty, 6 or 7 of them. A girl celebrated in my day for having big feet, named Katie Orchard, was swathed in bunting and had a bandage over one eye. She was gallant little Belgium. These, and other people dressed in patriotic but vague outfits, formed a procession, highly allegorical in its nature, which advanced down our main street, led by a band of 7 brass instruments and a thunderous drum. I rode after them in an open grey dort with the reeve, and following us was what was then called a Calathumpian parade, of gaily dressed children tormenting and insulting Myron Papal, who was identifiable as the German Emperor by his immense, upturned, false moustache. Myron hopped about and feigned madness and deprivation very amusingly, but with such vigor that we wondered how a fat man could keep it up for long. As ours was a small village, we toured through all the streets and went up and down the main street no less than 3 times. Even at that, we had done our uttermost by 2:45, and I had clumped down off the train at 1:30. It was the strangest procession I had ever seen, but it was in my honor, and I will not laugh at it. It was Deptford's version of a Roman